In this hour, I'm going to make you a little bit smarter, but gosh darn it, we're going to entertain you at the same time. The guy who's going to do that is Larry Reed. He is the president emeritus of the Foundation for Economic Education, all-round smart guy, and he takes the history of economics and actually makes it interesting. Never knew that could happen, Larry. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Mandy. Great to be on your show again, as always.
Well, you got a few good articles out. I've got them all on the blog today because one of the things I like about fee.org, which is the Foundation for Economic Education, I have a link to that as well, is that you guys write in small enough kind of bites that even if you're writing about a complex issue, you kind of break it down so somebody can go and read about it and be able to absorb that without being hit with too much information that they don't need. And I just wanted to comment on that.
Thanks, Mandy. Yeah, we try to do that, so I appreciate it. Appreciate your comment very much.
One of the articles that you sent me today is one that I have to say does not surprise me in the slightest, because as much as I have become interested in economics, in large part to you and your organization, to be perfectly frank, Larry, I hated learning about economics in school. And the unfortunate part about that, and this is the point of this column that you've written, economics is incredibly important. And kids are not learning even rudimentary economics in an unbiased way. And so they're kind of being indoctrinated instead of learning economic policy. And you start this column with economic illiteracy is dangerous. I can ride on a roller coaster without understanding centrifugal force. Physics can protect me whether I believe it or not, but if I ignore basic economics, I could go broke. And if a country ignores basic economics, it could go bankrupt. That's where we are, and yet, how did you get to say, wait a minute, what's in these textbooks that we're using to teach kids?
Well, this has concerned me for a long time. Back when I was teaching at the university level, Mandy, which was late 70s, early 80s, I found it difficult even then to find textbooks that were not loaded with bias or in which the authors really didn't understand economic history. And so they were saying silly things like, you know, the Great Depression was caused by the free market and Franklin Roosevelt saved us, that kind of nonsense. And so I've been worried about it for some time, but I think it's gotten worse in recent years. The woke culture is working its way into some of these textbooks, and certainly the big government agenda of progressives and socialists are very prominent in a lot of these textbooks, which means that the textbook authors, which in just about every case are economists, they have put objective fact aside and decided that in some cases their political agenda is more important than actual truth and history.
Let me ask you to walk this back to a very rudimentary explanation of the kind of most well-known two schools of economic thought, because I think that if you don't have an understanding of Keynesian economics versus sort of the Austrian or Hayek school of economics, I don't think that you can possibly understand how an economics textbook could be biased. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, well, Keynesian economics, which is named for John Maynard Keynes, a British economist who was quite prominent in the 1930s, and of course, long after he died, his ideas have been very popular in so many textbooks. But he was an architect of expansionary government. He believed that to help an economy that was in bad shape, that the government needed, even if the government caused it in the first place, he thought that it was government's duty to come in and spend more, create more money, and that sort of thing to stimulate the economy. He was not so concerned about the long run. In fact, he very famously said once when somebody asked him, Mr. Keynes, if we follow your advice and the government gets bigger, spends more, runs deficits, and prints money, won't the dollar go down in value, maybe become worthless someday? And his famous answer was, in the long run, we're all dead anyway.
Yeah, so, that's always nice. But I mean, didn't he advocate for paying down the debt in better times? That's the part
yes,
that seems to get lost.
That's right. I think even he would be horrified at the extent of deficit spending today. He didn't think that the government should run whopping deficits all the time.
Right.
He thought that they were in some way compensatory, that if the economy was down, then the government spending should go up. But if the economy was doing well, then government spending and deficits should go in the other direction. So, you know, to sort of offset each other. Now, there are a lot of fallacies baked into that, but still, that's a far cry from what government has been doing in recent years, which is spending $1 trillion more than it's got, even in the best of times.
Right. So let's talk about the other, the competing school of economics. And this is where anyone who is described as a right-leaning economist usually falls into the Austrian camp. So what is that side of the economics battle that's that we're doing right now?
Okay. The Austrian school is named for the fact that its founders were economists at Vienna, Austria, over a century ago. And in the succeeding decades, there were some very prominent Austrian economists who, from all over the world, who earned Nobel Prizes, who had deeply affected the thinking about economics. It's very much opposed to the Keynesian school, the Austrian school is, for a lot of reasons. One is it doesn't look at the economy in a collective sense. It doesn't look at the economy as lumps and groups, as if they are doing the thinking and the acting. Austrian economists break economics down to the level of the individual. And we do that because we think that only individuals really think and act and make decisions, become entrepreneurs, and so forth. That trying to analyze the economy as if there are gigantic blobs of collective entities making decisions is ridiculous. So we're very focused on the individual. We're very laudatory of the entrepreneur. Keynesians aren't so concerned about the entrepreneur, but we think the person who assembles the tools of production today, takes a risk, and makes products in the future, hoping that it will afford him a profit, is a hero. That person is an uncommon person who is at the front lines of innovation and producing a productive, free, prosperous economy.
And the dividing line for me as a person who sort of came to all this knowledge late is that when people look at the economy as a fixed pie, as in there are X amount of dollars and everyone has to fight to get their scrap of the pie, they're definitely going to be in the Keynesian camp. Because if you don't see the value in that entrepreneur creating more jobs and creating more economy, making the economy bigger so there's more pie for everyone, that would put you in the Austrian school.
Exactly right. Austrians view the economy as a dynamic place. The freer it is, the more dynamic it is, the more the future is uncertain, which gives entrepreneurs an opportunity to try to be there first with a new idea and push things ahead for everybody. We don't think the economy is some stagnant entity that you can put a microscope up to and watch it operate. It is actually a very complex entity, ever-changing and ever-dynamic as long as it's free.
So let's take this back now to textbooks, now that we kind of have that basic understanding of why something could be biased in one direction or another. It does seem to me, and the economy, the economics that I had to take in high school and then in college was definitely dry as dust, okay? I don't know if there was any bias because it was all equations and garbage, and there was no attempt at that time, I feel, to bring these concepts into the real world, and I think that is the fault of economists. And
Well, yeah, I think you've nailed it on the head. Keynesians especially love equations, mm-hmm. and they think that if they can summarize the economy in a few mathematical formulas, that they're on the cutting edge. They're really smart people. But Austrians say, wait a minute, even if you have a graph or a chart or an equation that summarizes some economic activity, all you've got is a fleeting moment in time. It's like a snapshot. It doesn't tell you anything about how the economy got to that point, where it's headed afterwards, and it certainly doesn't tell you about real decision-making, acting individuals, and what goes into the decisions that they make.
Right. So let's get back to the textbooks. How is this being played out right now in our schools?
Well, at the college level, you'll find that so many economics texts are chock full of graphs and equations. And some courses in economics at the college level leave you wondering, is this a course in mathematics or is it economics? They've heavily mathematized it to that extent. Whereas if you take a course from an Austrian economist, they may throw in a graph or an equation here and there, but they are quick to tell you that these things have very limited use. It's like, let's suppose you see a dog running across a field toward a fence, and as he gets to the fence, he leaps over it. And if you take a picture just as he's jumping over the fence, you wouldn't look at that picture and say, ah, dogs must live on top of fences. I mean, all you've got is one fleeting moment in time, and that picture doesn't tell you anything about why the dog was headed in that direction, what motivated him, where he's going afterwards. And human beings are infinitely more complex than dogs.
Well, most of us, anyway. I mean, you know, not all of us, Larry, for real. But the reason I wanted to talk about this particular story that you wrote is because we are really seeing the result of decades upon decades of progressive vision being made a part of our school system. And yeah. I don't want to make this political in that I'm not going to call anybody names, but the people that have been writing the curriculum for a very long time definitely want children to have the belief that government intervention in the economy is normal and good and necessary. And that government is a force for good in the economy, which is not a statement that you could make a good, compelling argument for. But in order to have good little citizens who comply with the power of government, this is what has to be done. And when you look at stuff like this and you throw in critical race theory, are we late to the party in getting to children super early, Larry? Because I feel like we are.
Well, in recent years, yeah, I think we are late to the party. We're working on it at fee, but we're up against the behemoth of the government school system, mm-hmm. which since the mid-60s has been increasingly centralized. It's not as local as it once was. Curricula often is determined by some committees at the state level. And with federal intervention in the form of federal aid and mandated curricula and so forth, you know, a lot of it is it starts in some distant bureaucracy at the federal level. So it's very hard to undo. And I see it all the time when we put on programs at fee for high school and college students. We find that much of the time we're having to undo mm-hmm. the miseducation that the students come to us with. And it's not as though they've been told, you know, various sides and left free to choose where they want to go or what which one they want to embrace. They don't even know that there's another side. They get the view that government is the answer to almost everything, and it has to help the economy in various ways. They don't even know what the other side is or who some of the principal people are who argue for that other side.
Let's talk reality. You brought up FDR and the Great Depression. You've written about that personally extensively, and I've recommended your 10 Myths of the Great Depression that you can get at fee.org to many, 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 many people. But we have two real-world examples of these two styles of economics clashing, and that is the extension of the Great Depression by FDR and then the contraction of the federal government after World War II. We have these real-world examples, and I think that if you had someone like you who could clearly say to college students, here are these two things that we did with far different results. We're seeing it now. Joe Biden has been in office 100 days, and the jobs report last Friday was pathetic. I mean, pathetic. So we see how these actions really impact us. And yet, when you go to an economics textbook, it's all those graphs that are A, going this way, and the Y and the X, and nobody cares. It's boring. And I think they do it on purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It certainly serves the purpose of expanding the size and the scope and the intrusiveness of the federal government. And that's the agenda of progressive educators. That's what they want ultimately to see. You mentioned in the two examples you just gave, the contraction of the federal government after the Second World War. You know that Keynesians don't like to talk about this because they want you to think that, when government grows by spending more, it helps the economy. And if it spends less, it hurts the economy. And yet after World War II, you have the most significant contraction of the federal government and its spending in American history, largely through wartime demobilization. And you didn't have a renewed depression. You had the economy taken off because all those resources were not squandered now by politicians or spent for the war effort. They were freed up for the private sector to put to use. And in 1945, we cut the corporate income tax rate from 90% to 38%. And the economy took off. And yet Keynesians don't want you to know about that occasion when spending went down, government spending, and the economy took off.
Now, let me ask you that in a more recent sense of economic policy, because we've had spending cuts. We had spending cuts under Donald Trump, but we certainly had no spending cuts to go with it. We had tax cuts, but we had no spending cuts. So because I have progressive friends that are like, you know, the tax cuts didn't do that much. I'm like, well, the economy was pretty dang good until the pandemic. I mean, let's be real. It was pretty dang good. But is it because government spending is so big that it is going to be harder? And I'm guessing, I think I'm asking you to speculate a little bit here, but is that going to make it harder to use the kind of economic tricks and tools that the Fed has employed previously to spark the economy when things slow down?
Yeah, I think the Fed, the Federal Reserve, has less room today to do its manipulations than it used to have. I mean, think of it. I mean, how much further could it depress interest rates?
Yeah.
Whenever the economy is in bad shape, which is almost invariably because of bad policy from the government previous to that, at least they've had room to lower interest rates in the short term and, quote, stimulate the economy. Now, I have a lot of problems with that in any event. But still, today, they've been keeping interest rates so low for so long, there's not much more room on the downside. And how much more room on the upside do we have in government spending? I mean, we're already looking at a $2 trillion deficit this year. So I think we're approaching the end of the line in terms of how much actual stimulative effect we can get from either the Fed or from government spending.
So we're going to take a quick time out. I'm talking with Larry Reed. He's the president emeritus now of the Foundation for Economic Education, one of my favorite economic nerds ever. Welcome back. We are talking to the president emeritus of the Foundation for Economic Education. It sounds very stuffy, but it is not at all. Larry Reed is with us, and we're talking kind of, you know, what I've learned doing this job is that I get a lot of questions from people that say things, Larry, like, well, you know, I didn't really learn that much in about economics, and they're embarrassed about it. And one of the things I love about FEE is that anybody, any age, any kind of, you know, educational level can go to FEE.org and learn all kinds of stuff about economics that is very useful and helpful. So I always recommend your site for people who want to know more about economics, just overall, you know, and you guys cover every topic. So I want to talk for a second about entrepreneurship for a second. You've got a good article about this, but about business failures. But it kind of goes with the conversation we had in the last segment about people taking risks and people creating new things. And if no one ever took a risk, we would have a completely stagnant economy, and we should be celebrating entrepreneurs every single day.
Yeah, absolutely, Mandy. And one of the great features of a good entrepreneur is that they don't take failure as a reason to quit. A good entrepreneur will typically fail multiple times over the course of their career, but in each case, if they're a good entrepreneur, they will learn from it and get back up on their feet and go off to achieve new things.
Well, you know, this is, you have two stories, both of them. I don't know why people would do business in Brazil after reading these two stories, but both of them were of men who had had great success prior to a massive failure.
Yeah. I wanted to write about these two and the ventures they undertook in Brazil because they were on a massive scale, these two ventures, and they both failed. One was the dream of Henry Ford. Of course, everybody knows Henry Ford is the founder of the Ford Motor Company. He was extraordinarily successful. He had just made the 15 millionth Model T in 1927. Wow. Yeah, 15 million of them, sold them for an average of a few $100 a piece. When he decided that he wanted to go to Brazil to create a sort of a rubber empire, you might say, so he could source his rubber from there, he was up against a British rubber monopoly, and he wanted a good source of readily available and inexpensive rubber to make tires with. So he decided to buy up a big chunk of Amazon jungle and create a town there. He gave it a name, Fordlandia.
Of course.
And yeah, he had all kinds of ideas about how he could bring American customs and even American food to Brazilians and that they would love it. Well, he was dead wrong about that. Brazilians didn't like hamburgers or canned food.
And, you know, but isn't that, I mean, isn't that in hindsight kind of the hubris of the white man? Could you imagine if he had gone down and just built a really nice village for the Brazilian people to live in a Brazilian way, if we'd be having a different conversation about Fordlandia?
Yeah, Henry Ford was right about a lot of things, but not this. And there was a little bit of that white man's burden attitude that he had, that, you know, that they should like what I want to give them.
Right.
And in fact, they have their own customs. So that was a big reason that Fordlandia flopped, because they were a different people. They didn't take too kindly to Ford wanting to transplant Michigan values and Michigan food to Brazil.
I can't imagine what that must have been like culture shock wise for, you know, I kind of want to go back in time and see that. You know, we do these philosophical questions once a week, and one of them was, if you could go to any time, maybe I'll go back to Fordlandia, Dave. That's what I'll see what went wrong there.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great to go back and look at it? Well, some of it is still around, dilapidated and rotting away in the jungle, but there are still structures, including the old water tower that he created, still there all these many decades afterwards.
Oh, that's kind of cool. Oh, I just pulled up pictures. Oh, wow. So he did. He built a little town here, and apparently no one wanted to live in his little town. It's beautiful. I'd live there in a broken-down factory. And then the other story also involved Brazil. I feel like Brazil has been one of those, if I can just conquer Brazil, I'm going to conquer the world kind of places.
Yeah, and this other story also involved another Michiganian. Just like Henry Ford, Daniel K. Ludwig was from Michigan. And he had made a ton of money over his life. He was a billionaire in things like shipping and all sorts of other ventures, hotels, insurance, orange groves, oil refining, cattle ranching, you name it. And he got this idea that he wanted to build a factory that would produce pulp paper, because the world needed more paper mills and more paper. And he was right about that. But he got the idea that the place to do it was in Brazil. And that's that was the tripping point, because he flopped at this. But the amazing thing is, the guy thought big. In fact, when he after he bought the land, he made an important decision. He thought that rather than build the pulp paper factory in Brazil, he decided it would make more sense to build it in Japan, and then in two big pieces, and transport the entire two pieces of that paper mill across the ocean and up the Amazon River. And that's exactly what he did. So, you know, even though it failed, as Fordlandia failed, I still celebrate people who think big, who and they're like the pioneers of the Old West. You know, they go places before anybody else does. And they fail sometimes at it, but we all learn from it. And I'm just grateful for the fact that people like Daniel K. Ludwig and Henry Ford could think big and had the freedom to put their dreams onto paper and into reality, even though some of them didn't work.
Well, you know what's interesting is, and I'm going to use Trump as a perfect example of this. Here's a guy who, over the course of his career, has tried a million different things. I mean, that man has put his name on a million different products, a million different things. Some of them worked better than others, but his failures in business were often used as some kind of damnation, you know, some kind of look, he's failed at all these things. And I'm like, but he tried all those things. You know, I never had an airline with my name on it. I never had the, you know, cojones or the money to put behind something like that. It's frustrating to me that being successful in business has now created this kind of divide between people who perceive business owners in one way as the evil overlords and laborers as the kind of angels that have to have their opportunity to be heard. And I've said this to many, many people in my lifetime who have said to me, I'm not being treated fairly. My boss is horrible. Worst job I've ever had. And I say, well, then start your own company.
Yeah.
You know, you have that freedom. And they say, well, I don't have enough money. I'm like, well, you know what? He probably didn't either when he started. You know, so it's we've got to remember that if these people don't innovate, there's no way to have big government if you're a big government type, because there's no one to pay taxes. So entrepreneurship and innovation and all of these crazy things that I look at and think, why are people going to buy a basket full of fruit decorated artfully at Edible Arrangements? But here we are decades later and Edible Arrangements is still a thing and people love it. So who am I to judge, you know?
And I mean, isn't it great that we still have a society where people feel as though they can take a chance and try something like that?
Yes,
People need to stop and think and ask themselves, do they really want a society where nobody is willing to take a risk, where everybody's happy with just the way things are, that nobody wants to innovate because that involves taking a chance? I don't think so. I mean, we would still be in caves if nobody stepped out and took a chance.
Exactly right. I mean, the first guy to try and make fire himself was quite the innovator. But we all know how that worked out. So there you go. Let's talk about the last story that you sent me today. This one from who? Tell me, first of all, I had never seen El American until you started posting it. What is this website about? I need to know something about here.
Okay. El American, which is Spanish, it means the American, was started back in November by two good friends who had for several years been journalists at the Pan Am Post. And they decided to venture out on their own and start a new website that would appeal primarily to people of Spanish-speaking countries and in the southern U.S., and the result is El American. And they asked me to write a weekly column for them, so I've been doing that since November. And the one I sent you was about Joe Biden and Jim Crow.
This Jim Crow nonsense about the Georgia voter lie, you're a resident of Georgia, so you know of what you speak here. We've said it on the show, and you said it beautifully in this column, to call the Georgia voter law a Jim Crow law craps all over the memory of the actual horror of the Jim Crow laws. And I thought I knew intellectually how bad they were, but yet I picked up some of the stuff that you mentioned in this column and really found out way more than I wanted to know about how bad this was and how its sole goal was to create and maintain a second class of society that would never be allowed to ascend beyond that second class. And it's fundamentally un-American. That concept is fundamentally goes against everything I believe it is to be an American. I believe that everybody should be able to rise above their circumstances no matter where they come from. And Jim Crow was designed to ensure that that never happened. And this Georgia voter law is nothing like that. But you go one step further to remind people where the Jim Crow laws came from, and it's not Donald Trump.
No, Jim Crow laws go way back to the late 19th century, and they were not just in the South for a long time. They were all across both North and South. And invariably, they were a project of the Democratic Party. And that's not a partisan statement. I'm not speaking as a Republican here. I'm just noting historical fact that Democrats were the party of Jim Crow, passing it in state after state or in localities, even in northern states, all designed to keep blacks in their place, keep them from being politically of any consequence, and separating them from white Americans in almost every place that the two races could mix and mingle. This was a Democratic Party project. Even Joe Biden's good friend, the Senate Majority Leader, Robert Byrd, was a Jim Crow advocate. In fact, he was unanimously elected exalted cyclops of his local Ku Klux Klan chapter. He was a Democrat.
Well, can you dispel very quickly, and I know you can or I wouldn't ask the question, the myth that somehow all of the Dixiecrats who were very invested in Jim Crow flipped over and became Republicans?
Yeah, you know, there was a split in the Democratic Party increasingly over time between the North and South. And as the northern wing of the Democratic Party became ever more left-wing, many of the Southerners left it. And it was not just over Jim Crow issues, but it was over economics, the role of government, the importance of adhering to the Constitution. And as many Southern Democrats began to realize the Northern Democrats were going in a very left-wing direction, they flipped over. And so what was once a solid...
Larry, I will tell you, out of the official Dixiecrat group, which was 25 legislators, only one changed his party. The rest remained Democrats until they were out of office. This is something I have looked up many times because I get really frustrated with people saying, oh, they all just became Republicans. No, they didn't. They stayed Democrats. One changed parties. That was it. The rest remained Democrats while they remained in office.
The region as a whole, though,
has
transformed. Yeah. Subsequent generations began the move away from the Democratic Party in the South. So if there is still a solid South today, it's not Democrat. It's largely Republican.
Well, you know, when people talk about calling the Georgia voter laws Jim Crow, there's only one purpose, and that is to make anything that seems like it's going to shore up election security racist so we can have less secure elections. I mean, isn't that... to me, anyway, that's where we are right now. You either want them to be secure or you want them not to be for whatever reason. And I feel like that's what's happening now.
I think the Democratic Party, unfortunately, has become the party that wants to make it so easy to cheat that they can get away with more of it. I really believe that. I think that's their motivation.
I will tell you that I, for a long time, thought, you know, there's a lot of people, rank and file Democrats, who truly, truly, truly just want everyone to be able to have access to the polls. But when you start to drill down and ask the follow-up questions like, do you really think that a modern African-American person is too stupid to have an ID?
Yeah.
When you start asking the questions behind this stuff, then it kind of starts to fall apart. And I do think that there are people in power who would love to cheat, for sure. But it's amazing to me that they're not concerned about cheating on the other side. I think that says good things about the Republican Party in a way, is they're not worried at all about mass scale, or maybe they just think they're too stupid to cheat. I don't know, Larry. I don't know.
Well,
I have no idea.
The Democratic Party has become the party of moral relativism. And I think, unfortunately, at least at the top in the leadership positions, maybe not yet broadly speaking amongst the rank and file, but among the Democratic leadership, They really want a system where it's easy for things like ballot harvesting to happen, where you can have mass mail-out ballots that are always going to be fraught with the potential for fraud. They want to make something that is so revered in America. It's a seminal aspect of American democracy that you should be able to cast a free and secret ballot. They want to make that so cheap that they can actually use their buddies to cheat. And I firmly believe that. You know, the Georgia law, among other things, outlaws mass mail-out balloting, not because Georgia wants to restrict access to the ballot. They just want to make sure that you're who you say you are when you vote and that ballots aren't coming in from people who aren't the ones who actually voted.
Larry, in Colorado, we have mass ballot mail-out, and every year some news station does a story where they go around to apartment complexes every single week when the mail comes, or every day when the mail comes in, and they just get handfuls of ballots for people that they threw them in the garbage because those people don't live there anymore. But those ballots are out in circulation. And, you know, we're always told in Colorado we've never had huge instances of voter fraud and we've never had any that's been proven. But the state has gone completely, utterly blue since we went to all mail-in balloting. So draw your own conclusions. I'm not saying anyone cheated, but it's definitely an advantage if you're going after uninformed voters who love free stuff. Larry Reed is the president emeritus of the Foundation for Economic Education. Their website, fee.org, that's F-E-E.org, is a phenomenal place to start. And you can even sign up to get, as it said, Larry, dank economic memes on the little pop-up. Dank, not just, that, see, my 30-year-old producer's like, yeah, I'll take dank economic memes all day. I'm not the target audience for that one. Larry, we'll talk to you again next month, my friend.
Okay, thank you so much, Mandy. Appreciate it.